Hi, everybody. It's 1 o'clock. It's Monday, and it's time for Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafa. We are continuing our ongoing discussion of the penultimate Mishnah in the second chapter of Pirkei Avot. I think we're going to actually finish it. I think I'm actually going to finish it today because that's a lot more to say. Let's review. We're talking about Mishnah 14. It's not the penultimate. I'm sorry. It's the there were 16 Mishnayot, so we're talking number 14. Rabbi Elazar said, he was wont to say, Heve shakud, or heve shoked, be eager, be anticipate all the time, be, you know, really very enthusiastic about learning Torah. Veda ma shetashiv l'apikoris. Know what to reply to an apikoris. And that's where we're going to stop right now. Now, we've been discussing the past number of weeks, this will be the third time, the definition of what does it mean, damash tashiv lapikoros. And we've discussed the fact that the imperative to reply to the non-believer, to the disbeliever, it changes its identity. In other words, there are always outside religious, there are always intellectual and spiritual and moral challenges that are posed to the Torah. And people don't hesitate to to put them forward. And what Rabbi Elazar is saying is that there's a mandate. The Torah mandates that we or people that people should, some people should prepare themselves to encounter these, to engage these, and refute attacks upon the Torah. What we've been looking at is the way that the identity of that of those challenges changes. The original Epicureans, and then there were others, and we'll talk about a few more today. Last week I started to mention also the question of who is the Epicurus in terms of from whence does the challenge come, and what is the relationship with the first part, with the relationship between the first part and the second part of this Mishnah. So I'm going to try to put all of that together today because this conversation could go on forever. I'd love to go on forever, but we have, as I said, have a whole Masechta here. But I'd like to start off by making a couple of salient points. Number one, as I've noted, there is a difference of opinion as to the actual wording of this Mishnah. Heve shakud lilmod Torah, be eager or be diligent to study Torah, vedama shetashiv lapikoris, and know what you reply to an apikoris. That vav is very important. In other words, are these two separate statements? Sometimes you study a lot of Torah, and you should also know how to reply to the outside world. Or are they dependent? In other words, Heve shakud lilmod Torah, be eager to study the Torah, and as a result of your Torah study, you'll know how to reply to outside challenges. I was stunned, and originally I thought, I'll tell you in a minute originally I thought that the difference wasn't that great, because the major point is still made. However, it's really striking, and I am still trying to, well, I don't like this expression, but I'm still trying to contemplate. I was going to say I wrap my head around, but I really don't like that expression. There is a series of commentators who say the only way to reply to Epicurus, to reply to outside challenges, to Judaism, is to not study outside wisdom. In other words, Heve shakud l'lmod Torah, be diligent to study Torah, and as a result of studying nothing else but Torah, you'll know how to reply to the outside world. I'm not sure how that works, because the truth of the matter is, as I'll say and point out in a minute, in order to be able to respond to outside challenges, you need to know the nature of the challenge, which means you really need to know what is the outside culture posing to you, and what kind of ideas are being offered up, and what kind of criticism is being voiced vis-a-vis the Torah. And unless you know exactly where the critic is coming from, how are you going to be able to respond? So I really don't understand that that position, unless the point is that you should really not engage the outside world. You should batten down the hatches. You should withdraw within the Dalet Amot Shel Halacha, the four L's, the four cubits of the Torah, and say, you know, like, I'm just going to learn, and I'm ignoring you totally. That is a philosophy. There are those who took that position. In the 19th century, that was essentially the position of what later became the Haredi world, vis-a-vis the Enlightenment and early, middle, and late modernity. That, let's just learn Torah. That's our answer to that Bikaris. That's how we're going to survive, and that's it. And the truth of the matter is that there was something, practically speaking, there was something to say for that. As you see, the growth and the strength of the Haredi world today. I don't think that that's possible today, for the simple reason that the internet just simply invades every square inch of our lives, including Bnei Brak, including Mea Shearim and Geula and Lakewood and all kinds of other places in Brooklyn. And as a result, I don't know whether it's a good tactic or strategy or not. It's not effective, so I don't think it makes a. I don't think it's helpful. So that's one way of interpreting this Mishnah. Another way of looking at the same combination of damasha takshiv l'bikaris being dependent upon Talmud Torah is that is more Maimonidean, and it's something that I once heard from Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, in a discussion. In fact, I think it's yes, I believe it's recorded. In one of his drushes about Hanukkah, he talked about the challenge that was posed to the Torah by Hellenistic philosophy, civilization, culture. And towards the end, he sort of waxed poetic, and he said that, in his opinion, it's not enough to have 13 articles of faith if we're going to follow Maimonides' enumeration, but rather there's a 14th. And the 14th article of faith is that I believe with unsullied faith, that the Torah can respond to any challenge without losing its integrity. In other words, all of the challenges that are raised against the Torah can be responded to. However, that requires profound Torah learning to be able to do that and not to disfigure and not to distort and not to misrepresent the Torah. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't know what the nature of the challenge is, which obviously the Rav Soloveitchik would not have agreed with, because he certainly did advocate a broad secular education at the alongside of, although subsidiary to, a traditional and extensive, in-depth traditional Jewish education, Torah, in the broadest sense. However, nevertheless, it's only by going into the Torah in depth that you can really have the fortitude and the confidence to be able to engage in debate. And we saw that Lashiv means to debate. So those are two ways of looking at that, at this first sentence, if the Vav is in place, meaning that your ability to be able to respond will, in fact, be a direct result of an enthusiastic and committed involvement in the study of Torah. So that was point number one. Point number two. And I this is not something I really want to go into, but I think it's important to state. The question is, when we talk about who is the apikoros, I have been emphasizing the question of what is the ideology and what is the approach that is being offered in criticism of the criticism of Judaism. I didn't mention who is the apikoros in the sense of, you know, whence does the criticism come? Does the criticism come from within? Or does the criticism come from without? I noticed, strikingly, of all people, the Maimonides, Rambam, in his commentary on Pirkei Avot says, he makes a very sharp distinction. He said, don't debate other Jews in matters of religion. Forget it. He says, you'll never get anywhere because they can't hear it. In other words, an intramural debate about religion with other Jews is a dialogue of the deaf. People are only going to, it's like a fight in the family. the people are going to dig in their heels, and they're only going to get their backs up and forget it. There's nothing to talk about. When the mission is talking about an Epicurean or a person who is attacking or criticizing or polemicizing against Judaism, we're only talking about non-Jews. Non-Jews can listen, but Jews, forget it. It's not even worth it. I have no idea whether that's always true. It's certainly, certainly in the world of Facebook and Twitter, it's true, but that's part of one of the negative parts of social media, where there is no dialogue. All there is yelling and screaming. But it is something to keep in mind, because in an intramural or inside or internal family dispute, emotions can get in the way of any kind of reasoned exchange. So that's point number two. Let's get back though to the discussion of who is the apikoros in terms of the identity of the challenges that is posed to the. To the Jewish people, into Judaism. So last week we ended with a comment by Rabbi Yonah of Gerona, cousin and mechutin of Ramban, a famous person of great piety and also of tremendous Talmudic scholarship, in which I suggested that his identification of the Epicurean as a person who advocates or denies the veracity of the oral law of the Torah Shebaal Peh, that refers to Karaites, and we discuss the fact that the Karaites constituted a very serious alternative and threat to rabbinic Judaism for a very, very long time. There is another possibility at the time, and in Rabbeinu Yonah, and that is that at the same time as Rabbeinu Yonah was, towards the end of his life, actually in the 30s of the 13th century, the Catholic Church began a campaign which lasted many, many hundreds of years, and to a certain degree still exists today, against the oral law, against the Torah Shebaal Peh, against the Talmud in particular. In fact, until the Daf Yomi phenomenon, it's interesting, until the Daf Yomi phenomenon took off, not the beginning of this cycle, but the beginning of last cycle, when Google actually was in its infancy, if you put the word Talmud into Google, you got reams of anti-Jewish sites that describe how the Talmud is a terrible thing and it's anti-human and all kinds of horrible stuff. And those sites still exist, but there's so many Daf Yomi places that the sort of like they get dragged that those are what comes up first. Or at least by me, maybe a person who doesn't look up stuff for odd things with Daf Yomi won't get the same kind of responses. I have no understanding of how algorithms work, so I'm not going to take any responsibility for how that goes. In any event, there is this long history of attacking the Torah Shebaal Peh, of attacking the Talmud as a sinister document which blasphemes against Jesus, all kinds of things, in order to do one of two things, or actually both. One of them is to, in the original context, was to undermine the possibilities of Jewish existence. The Church realized in the first quarter of the 13th century already that the Judaism is not based on the Bible alone, but also on the Talmud, and that if you destroy the Talmud, the capacity for Jewish, the ability of Jews to be able to exist will actually collapse. So if we destroy the Talmud, then the Jews will not be able to sustain themselves as Jews. And since they won't be able to sustain themselves as Jews, they will fall like ripe fruit into the hands of the Church. This led to the first trial of the Talmud in 1240, the burning of 24 cartloads worth of Talmudic manuscripts in Paris in June of 1242. And this is an ongoing business. And as I told you, this sort of angle, this sort of tactic still exists. Simultaneously, the idea being, since the Talmud is such a nefarious document, it just shows to show you that the Jews are diabolical. And since the Jews are diabolical, so we should hate the Jews, persecute the Jews, expel the Jews, whatever the case might be. I will add that same approach to sort of neutralizing or taking the Talmud away from the Jews morphed about in the 1260s into a different approach, which is also, it's less common today than it was, but it certainly was very common throughout the Middle Ages into the modern period, the assertion that the attack on the Torah Shebal Peh of the oral law is not because it's something bad, but because it's something that is good. What do I mean? The thought developed that the rabbis in the Talmud, of course, were contemporaries of Jesus and his, it's one of the earliest ones, of Jesus and his followers. So since they lived then, the believing Christian would, of course, come to the conclusion that Jesus was all that they say he was. And they saw the miracles and so on. But the Jews, of course, are stubborn. They're thick, they're stiff-necked people. So the rabbis refused to acknowledge it. So what did they do? They compartmentalized it. They suppressed it. And they made fun of Jesus, too. But basically, this is way before Freud, the Christians asserted the idea of the Freudian slip, meaning that, it's a Freudian slip. When you say something and you mean to say X, but you say Y. But Y is what you're really thinking. X is really just something. It's just a cover-up. So the same thing over here. The Jews wanted to hide the fact that Jesus was the Messiah. But nevertheless, they let slip all kinds of hints throughout the Talmud. And all you need to do is to be able to collect all of these slips. And you'll find out that the Talmud is basically a Christian document. And since a Christian document, the Jews want to be loyal to the Talmud. So therefore, they have to become Christian. In fact, if they don't get the hint, then they're in fact heretics against their own religion, which I know that sounds very, very strange, but that was the argument. And so Rabbeinu Yonah is not talking about that. There's no question because it's developed after he died. But this sort of obsession with the Talmud and the oral law, which marked Christian attitudes towards Judaism. Certainly well into the modern era, and I've argued in an article that it even finds a couple of echoes in the protocols of the Elders of Zion, is part of this. So that would be the apikoris. That's, in other words, it's an outside challenge from the church. Although the people that developed it were former Jewish apostates who converted to Christianity and wished to convert their former brethren. So that's another apikoris. And then you have others who say that Apikoros is a Jew who has lost his faith because of too much involvement in Jewish philosophy. So I wish I could have more Torah to defeat them. And on and on and on. What's striking, what's really very striking, is what happens a touch later. When we jump forward to the 16th century, to the era of the ghetto, when Jews are slowly being taken out of the Christian mainstream throughout Europe, except in Poland, which is another story, but certainly central Europe and Italy, when you get to the commentary on Avot by the Maharal Prague, the great Rabbi Low of Prague, he says that fighting against an Apikoros means fighting against evil and shekin, falsehoods. That's true, but it's sort of anodyne. It's sort of, it always struck me as being very parv. Yeah, okay. You could say that anytime you want. And I want to suggest that the reason why there's nothing really burning in the words of the Maharal, at least as far as I can read it, because when the Jews were in the ghettos, and this is true of the Pale Settlement as well, until the 19th century, they were really isolated, by and large, from the outside world. And there were no real pressing heresies, certainly not until the Sabbateans in the 17th century. And as a result, the power and the sort of the force that attended upon the word Apikoros, it sort of flew away. And then the Jews are thrown out of the ghettos, modernity forces itself in, and then you get all kinds of other identifications of who the Apikoros is. The Apikoros Frankist, in other words, a follower of Shabtai Tzvi, one of the more radical ones, is the Apikoros the Maskil, a person who wants Jews to study, secular studies in the 18th, 19th century. is the upbeat color, is the reformer or the conservative Jew. You find in modern or the person who advocates an atheist or anti-Jew or anti-religious kind of position. The apikores could be the Zionist, the apikores could be the communist, the apikores could be the socialist, the apikores could be all kinds of different people. And in fact, you find that the challenge changes. And in 19th and 20th century commentaries on Avot, many of which have not been published relatively, in relatively limited forms, you can see very clearly that that the old pattern of identifying the apikores with the most recent challenge to traditional Judaism that kicks back into place. The towards that end, as I said, this is the last time we're going to discuss this. There is something that I would like to mention in terms of what I perceive. I generally don't make, it's not a political comment, but sort of contemporary comments on, in this year. But I think it's striking. The contemporary situation that Orthodoxy finds itself, I think requires some, bringing it into this discussion. What do I mean? One of the differences between the Orthodox response and even the Neo-Orthodox response, in other words, modern Orthodox or Neo-Orthodox, according to the school of Reb Shamshon Feurel Hirsch, was that up until like 1980s, and you can maybe peg it to the retirement of Rabbi Soloveitchik, there was a lot of Orthodox involvement, both in both in the United States and Canada and elsewhere, in England and in France, and interestingly to a lesser degree in Israel, and modernity. In other words, a critical engagement with the values of modernity, out of a lot of appreciation of modernity, to see exactly where the interface between traditional Jewish values and traditional Jewish ideas and institutions and so on, where that interface could be with modern ideas. What's incredibly striking is the fact, and that was a result of deep involvement by prominent thinkers, first-rate thinkers, in both Torah in the narrow sense, and also closer familiarity with the best has been thought and written in the outside world. It was a critical involvement, meaning that not everything that the outside world had to say could ultimately be squared with Jewish values, and there were certain differences, certain borders or boundaries that had to be set. But still, it was a creative interaction between two civilizations or two cultures that have their own integrity. And for those of you who are into the lingo, yeah, to a significant degree, I am an essentialist in many, many ways. What's striking today is the fact that from the 1980s on, there is no, or has been no, significant Jewish philosopher who critically and creatively engaged and debated postmodern culture, postmodern civilization. I'm sure some of you are going to listen to this and say, well, Rabbi Sachs, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, did. To a certain degree, but not, that wasn't the center of his oeuvre. What do I mean? I mean that the idea that one has to go to the roots of the challenge from the outside and examine it, and see exactly, you know, what it stands for and what it doesn't stand for, and to see critically if that can be squared at all with Judaism. That work, which was done for modernity, was not done here. And as a result, I mean, we emphasized the Orthodox Jewish community was very happy to, and it was a wonderful achievement to create rabbis and preachers and certainly Talmidei Chachamim, rabbinic scholars and deciders of halacha. But it dropped the ball, and here, you know, especially the world of Yeshiva University dropped the ball in a most horrific way. It dropped the ball when it came to providing guidance as to how to respond to demands by the outside world in matters that are antithetical to the Torah. Now, this can refer to sexual morality. This can refer to the question of individual autonomy, the question of whether is there a place for authority, even the idea of a Jewish people, which is under tremendous attack from the outside world. There are no Orthodox or traditional thinkers or writers who take the bull by the horns to defend values and issues, values and I don't know, dogmas that, or even the very idea of truth that lie at the center of Judaism, and which Judaism cannot, the Torah cannot, under any circumstances or any situation, give in on. So it might very well be, as Rav Soloveitchik said, that the Torah has nothing to fear, but you got to know enough. One has to know enough Torah and to be able to take, as in Israel they say in the army, to take the fight over to the territory of the other guy, into enemy territory, to properly respond, to be able to do that. And as a result, increasingly, one sees, ostensibly even Orthodox leaders, representatives, who have gone native. They're not even aware of the fact that many of the positions, many of the things which the outside world advocates aggressively, and this is not just the extreme woke culture and progressive culture, there are other things as well. They don't know how to respond to that because they don't even realize that they're being taken in, because many ideas and many things have just become sort of a common coin in cultural discourse. So that I think that so if I were to write a parish, a commentary on Avot today, I would say Havei Shakud L'lmod Torah, deepen profoundly your study of Torah in the broadest sense of the term. That includes not just Gemara, that in terms includes the entire Jewish philosophical tradition. And also understand that there may be good things in the outside world and some things not, but you have to have the tools to be able to critically engage them and to realize, to be able to say, this is okay, this is not okay. And then learn how to refute, from an Orthodox point of view, from a traditional Jewish point of view, the assumptions, or at least respond to the assumptions of the outside. I mean, for example, I'll give an example which is not, which just as a possibility. The contemporary culture, contemporary Western culture assumes that every person is totally autonomous. They can do whatever they want, and you know, especially in things that are the most intimate things that we have. That may be true. That's there, but nobody can tell anybody anything unless it's a matter of convenience or a matter of, you know, the right of my fist ends at the end of your nose. Judaism doesn't teach that. We believe in free will. But it's interesting, the things that the outside world says are the private and sole possession of the individual, the Torah says, do not belong to you. The Torah says that our lives don't belong to us, our bodies don't belong to us, and our reputations don't belong to us. They belong to God. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't, that there's no room for, I don't know, plastic surgery. It doesn't mean that there's a blanket ban on abortion. But the fact that it's a question that needs to be asked. In other words, if you will, before you get plastic surgery, ostensibly, and Moshe Feinstein, for example, has a bunch of responses like that, about this, you ask, is this justified or not justified? So if the Torah allows it, doesn't allow it, doesn't allow it. But it's a question, it's not a given, because the right, because it's not a right, it's not our, not something we own. Now, that's the exact opposite, that's the polar opposite of the outside world says, I can do whatever I want. The same thing with abortion. Yes, we, the Judaism does not accept the idea that that you can under no circumstances abort a fetus. Well known. But the fact that there's a question involved is very different than saying, I'm going to do what I want. Which is another principled position, which is not the Jewish position. There's a wonderful journalist, Avital Chizik Goldschmidt, wrote an article about the, well known that there are certain, in the Haredi community, that there are certain rabbis who are more lenient in terms of allowing for abortion and others, but that's not the point. The point is, the minute it becomes a problem or something has to be asked, it means that you have to accept the authority of the Torah on your body or on your mind or on your life or whatever the case might be. So that's a frontal collision between the two. Am I totally autonomous or am I autonomous and simultaneously responsible to something larger? Does a people have a right to make demands on me a priori simply because I exist? The outside world says no. The Torah says yes. Are Jews a nation? The outside world says there's no nations. The Torah says we are a nation. Not necessarily a nation with a flag, but a group of people bound together by the Torah. That's our constitution. Whether we obey it, whether some obey it or not, they're part of it because that's the constitution into which they are born obligated. Choose to do it. They can choose to obey it or not, and that's matter of freedom and will. You follow? So that if I were to write a commentary on Pirkei Avot, I would say, in contemporary terms, Hevesha kod l'lmod Torah, be eager and anxious to learn Torah as much as possible, in depth as possible, as widely as possible, and prepare yourself thereby, and that means including secular studies for their own sake, because they can be enriching, but also in order to respond to the outside world, because otherwise the outside world will engulf you. And that can be corrosive. Because the greatest danger, and a danger that pops up very, very often, is not to be aware of the fact that you've been sort of, engaged, you've uncritically embraced another set of values, and you decorate it. You say, "Well, I can make it Jewish." To a certain degree, some things can be incorporated. No question, a lot of things can be incorporated. One of the wonderful things about modernity is the empowerment of women. For example, phenomenal. That was a challenge in the outside world, and we saw that. Wow, that's something we should really have to do. Other things are less possible. But unless you have the Havesha Kod L'Lmod Torah in the Wad sense of the term, you won't be able to know Masha Teshiv Lapi Kavris, and that can be very, very fraught. Okay, that is where we'll end this. We will continue Mirat Hashem next week and finish this Mishnah and get to actually two very, very famous Mishnayot of Rabbi Tarfon, and then we will make a siyum on the second parak in Avot, which has taken us, I don't even know how long. And for those of you who are finishing Seder Moed and Chagiga, Masechta Chagiga and Seder Moed tomorrow, Mazel Tov. Those of you who, I strongly recommend that those of you who have the time, make the effort to try to join Daf Yomi. It's a wonderful way to get into a general sort of dynamic and rhythm of Torah study. There are so many tools out there that even though some of this last chapter in Chagiga was terrible, it was just very hard. There's enough out there for everybody at every different level. And there is nothing that unites the Jewish people more than Torah. If those of you who women who are might be interested, I recommend very strongly. There's going to be a, I think it's a worldwide hadron, worldwide sort of marking or celebration of finishing this major milestone of finishing a whole theater of the Shas on the Hadron, H-A-D-R-A-N network. And you can Google it, and I'm sure it's on Facebook too. And I strongly recommend it, and you'll be inspired, I am sure. All right, so we will see you. Be well. We'll see you next week.